just in terms of the president making an end run around Congress. Here he said, let us respect what the committee will do, and then he walks away from it. But in any event, the president is doing an end run about Congress, about the power of the purse. You've heard me say over and over again, Article 1, the legislative branch, the power of the purse, the power to declare war, many other powers listed in the Constitution, and, of course, the responsibility to have oversight. So the president is doing an end run around that. We will review our options. We'll be prepared to respond appropriately to it. I know the Republicans have some unease about it, no matter what they say, because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion that he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people. You want to talk about a national emergency? Let's talk about today, the one-year anniversary of another manifestation of the epidemic of gun violence in America. That's a national emergency. Why don't you declare that emergency, Mr. President? I wish you would. But a Democratic president can do that. Democratic president can declare emergencies as well. So the precedent that the president is setting here is something that should be met with great unease and dismay by the Republicans. And of course, we will respond accordingly when we review our options. First, we have to see what the president actually says.
And the Center for Constitutional Rights, a New York-based progressive legal organization, has been suing the Trump administration over its border policies. Staff attorney Angelo Guisado says at the heart of Trump's threat of declaring a national emergency is an appeal to a xenophobic, anti-immigrant base.
Anyone who believes in a just and functioning democracy should be worried about the president's unlawful and unjustified declaration of a national emergency.
Why?
There is no emergency. And there's sort of two parts to this. The first is that to the extent that the president is saying that the migration crisis constitutes a national emergency, the fact is that individuals apprehended at the border have been steadily declining over the past two decades. In fact, apprehensions at the border over the last 11 years are down about 71-72%. So to the extent that he says this is an emergency now, it's not based in fact whatsoever. Moreover, if there actually is a national emergency, it's more of an international emergency, and that emergency is sending people who have valid asylum claims over the border and back into Mexico, into very extraordinarily dangerous border towns, many of which I've been to, and many of which the Department of State has sent out travel warnings indicating that United States personnel are forbidden from traveling through there. So that's the sort of thing that we're dealing with.
What could be the long-term effect here in the United States on our system of government?
Well, this sort of despotic behavior, if left unchecked, could vastly undermine our democratic system of checks and balances. Congress spoke clearly when it passed today's the Senate spoke clearly when it passed today's resolution, and I anticipate the House will too, in that the financial funds won't be used for a border wall. I mean, it may be used for some fencing. I believe $1 billion out of the Trump's requested $5 billion would be, but the president cannot act where Congress has indicated otherwise. And this is nothing more than a power grab and an attempt at the executive to hoard power over the legislature, which is something we've seen throughout Trump's entire presidency.
What kind of long-term damage could that have?
If the president's allowed to declare a national emergency over something so frivolous and non-existent as the border emergency, I mean, there's no telling what he could do. He could seize internet records. He could seize personal data. He could, I don't even want to give him ideas at this point. But the point is that the founding fathers very intentionally initiated a system of checks and balances for government. And so the legislature and the judiciary here are going to have to come up big to avoid this sort of despotic, tyrannical system that the president's initiating.
Nancy Pelosi said that maybe the next president, if that's a Democrat, could declare a national emergency if there was another shooting like Parkside, which happened a year ago today.
There have been 349 shootings since Parkland, and there has been no national emergency declared. I mean, to the extent that a future president feels that that's something more pressing, I think they'd be more justified than a non-existent border crisis.
Now, there's actually been quite a few national emergencies declared over the last 30 or 40 years. A lot of them are still in place. We haven't seen any reduction in our freedoms because of those, or have we?
And I think Obama had 12 or 13. George Bush declared 13. The traditional national emergencies relate to war, national defense, public health, natural disasters. I think those are more appropriate than our immigration system, which is sort of should be left up to legislative will and not executive mandate. I think the National Emergencies Act in 1976, when passed, sort of let the president deal with, like, the Iran hostage crisis, for instance, or perhaps, like, swine flu, I believe, the national emergency was invoked. And I think those are traditionally more properly reserved for, you know, for actual emergencies. I think, if anything, they could declare an emergency over the opioid crisis, which I haven't heard the president reference in quite some time, and is actually causing a significant amount of harm and death in our country.
Anything that the CCR is going to do, take on a lawsuit or things like that, or sign on to a lawsuit?
I mean, CCR is counsel in two different cases, East Bay Sanctuary versus Trump and Al Otro Lado versus Trump, which deal with access to asylum process at the border. The real crisis is the United States' humanitarian failure to those tired, huddled masses who are marooned at the border, destitute, just seeking the ability to rightfully ask for safe haven. And the Trump administration's stark rebuke of international human rights principles and their obligations is the actual crisis.
Angelo Gazzato is a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate on Thursday voted to confirm William Barr as Attorney General. The vote was 54-45. The confirmation of Trump's nominee, who will oversee Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe, has been expected given the GOP's 53-47 control of the chamber. He was sworn in several hours later at the White House. Barr, 68, who had been counsel at the Kirkland & Ellis law firm, served as Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush from 1991 until 1993, following an 18-year civil service career that began at the CIA. The new Attorney General, nominated by Trump in December to replace Jeff Sessions, will be only the second person to hold the job twice. While Attorney General under the Bush administration, he facilitated the presidential pardons of several officials, either charged or convicted of crimes, including Elliot Abrams, who is now Trump's special envoy to Venezuela. A former reporter for the Washington Post, Jefferson Morley, is editor of the Deep State blog. He says Barr defended the actions of the Central Intelligence Agency during the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. Morley adds that Barr is a supporter of broad presidential powers.
The interesting thing about Barr in the context of today is his history in the 1980s coming up to the Justice Department and his first turn as Attorney General in 1992. And in these positions, Barr was a resolute defender of CIA covert action, of preventing accountability for the CIA, for protecting CIA operations from congressional oversight, from protecting CIA officials who had been indicted for crimes. So he's really been an advocate from the earliest days of his career for secret government and been an opponent of transparency and accountability.
He was involved in pardoning a lot of the people involved in Iran-Contra, wasn't he?
As Attorney General, he was the Attorney General in President Bush's last year in office, and three top CIA officials had been indicted for their role in the Iran-Contra conspiracy, which was a conspiracy of Reagan White House officials and top CIA officials to circumvent a ban, a congressional ban on aid to counter-revolutionaries in Latin America. They were coming to trial in 1992. There was a special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, who had brought charges against Dewey Claridge and Claire George, who had been two very senior CIA officials who were involved in the conspiracy. A third top CIA official had turned state's witnesses and was going to testify against the other two. At the end of his term, President Bush had been defeated, and he asked what he should do, and Barr recommended that everybody involved in the Iran-Contra conspiracy be pardoned. So Claire George, Dewey Claridge, and Alan Fiers were all pardoned. And so was Elliot Abrams, who had also been convicted of two counts of misleading Congress. So all of those people got off the hook and were never held accountable for their crimes. In Abrams' case, admitted crimes. And in the case of the CIA officials who were never convicted, alleged crimes. So that's Barr's record. I mean, that was what he was very adamant about in his conversations with the first President Bush. He used a phrase, I can't remember what it was, but it was like, you know, Bush was saying, well, maybe I should just pardon Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. And Barr said, no, in for a dime, in for a dollar, pardon everybody. And so Abrams and the CIA officials were all pardoned as well. The point being today that, you know, here was a chance to hold people accountable for criminal acts, for trying to bypass Congress, unconstitutional acts. And you know, Barr was in favor of protecting them from justice and preventing Congress and the public from holding them accountable.
Is Attorney General Barr in there now to help with that kind of opinion, you know, that view of the world? You know, you can't help but imagine him working with Donald Trump to pardon all these people in the Mueller investigation.
We don't know what he's going to do, but given that track record, it would be unsurprising if he did anything but try and, you know, protect people of guilty acts, prevent transparency, prevent accountability from going forward. Based on his record, that's what he's most likely to do.
In the past, they waited till after the guy was out of office to pardon everybody, but now they're going to pardon the guy in office is going to start pardoning.
Yeah, and so, you know, that is a significant difference. I mean, in the Iran-Contra case, the CIA officials had not gone through the justice system. They were still awaiting trial. Elliot Abrams had been convicted on two counts of lying to Congress and had pleaded guilty. But in the case of the Iran-Contra conspirators, you know, Barr was fully in favor of pardons before the judicial process had run its course. So that's another ominous precedent for the current situation.
Representative Omar straight out pretty much accused Elliot Abrams of being a war criminal. I think she used the term. Is that a fair description of Elliot Abrams?
Yeah, Elliot Abrams in the 1980s was a persistent liar. There's really no doubt about that, about the human rights situation in El Salvador and Guatemala, which was atrocious. Those countries were under a reign of terror from the local security forces. And Abrams discredited and denounced anybody who criticized those governments. He tried to discredit the human rights organizations. It was so bad that the established human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch started issuing a counter report to refute the fallacious and misleading and deceptive human rights reports that Abrams was writing for the State Department. And eventually the State Department itself had to start correcting itself because Abrams' reports were so lacking in credibility that it was discrediting the department. So his record, you know, at that time as somebody who would, you know, tell the truth about, you know, a terrible human rights situation, it was awful. He was a persistent liar. And not surprisingly, that's what he was convicted for.
Jefferson Morley is editor of the Deep State blog and a former Washington Post reporter. At a luncheon speech to a U.S.-led Middle East security conference in Warsaw, Poland, Vice President Mike Pence calls on Germany, France, and Britain to withdraw from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. The signature deal of former President Barack Obama was overturned by Trump, but is still supported by the other signatories.
And countries across the globe are working toward cutting Iranian oil imports to zero. But sadly, some of our leading European partners have not been nearly as cooperative. In fact, they've led the effort to create mechanisms to break up our sanctions. Just 2 weeks ago, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom announced the creation of a special financing mechanism designed to oversee a mirror image transaction that would replace sanctionable international payments between EU businesses and Iran. They call this scheme a special purpose vehicle. We call it an effort to break American sanctions against Iran's murderous revolutionary regime. It's an ill-advised step that will only strengthen Iran, weaken the EU, and create still more distance between Europe and the United States. Some argue that Iran is in technical compliance with the narrow terms of the deal, but compliance is not the issue. The deal is the issue. Today, America's economic sanctions on Iran are the toughest in history and will get tougher still unless and until Iran changes its dangerous and destabilizing behavior. As President Trump has said, there's been enough suffering, death, and destruction. Let it end now.
Dan Kovalik is author of The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. He says Trump is picking potential war criminals to spearhead his plans in South America and Iran.
Twice Congress cut off aid to the Nicaraguan Contras, which was a terrorist group that was trying to undermine the Nicaraguan revolutionary government that had overthrown the U.S.-backed dictator Anastasio Somoza. Well, twice Congress, in what is known as the Boland Amendments, cut off aid to the Contras because of how brutal they were. They would rape and kill villagers. They would destroy civilian infrastructure. So in any case, Congress cut off aid, but this did not deter Ronald Reagan and his gang of henchmen, who found ways to fund the Contras, one, by selling arms to Iran in exchange for cash that they used to fund the Contras. Now, this was particularly malicious because at that time the U.S. was also arming Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and Iraq and Iran were involved in a brutal war with each other at the time. So what, in effect, was happening was that the U.S. was now arming both sides of a conflict. And it made the conflict longer. It ended up being an eight-year war in which about 1 million people died. Meanwhile, the other thing that the Reagan administration and the CIA did to fund the Contras during this time was to sell cocaine on the streets of the United States in the inner cities and use the money, again, to fund the Contras. This was exposed by a journalist named Gary Webb. So this is very disturbing what happened because, one, it was clearly a unconstitutional move to fund the Contras, even though Congress had cut off aid. So it was very undemocratic, but it was also quite nefarious the way they went around Congress to do this funding. So now you see all these people involved somehow in the Iran-Contra scandal now being appointed to high office by Donald Trump. And, of course, the question is why? And I think, you know, the answer is that Trump is now focusing again on regime change operations in Latin America, in Venezuela, but also, as John Bolton signaled with his Troika of Tyranny speech, he's looking at Cuba and Nicaragua as well. So clearly, he's bringing back these folks who engaged in criminal activity. Some of them went to jail for a time for that activity to illegally fund the Contras. And he's brought them back, most likely, and certainly clearly in the case of Elliot Abrams, to lead regime change operations, particularly in Venezuela.
Dan Kovalik is author of The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World.